Good morning. We're delighted to welcome you all to our third day of oral argument. And we are especially delighted to welcome the Mishicot High School students. Would they stand, please? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. I think this is a regular class that comes here. Thank you, and thanks to your teacher who's participated in many of our programs. And we also have students from a neighboring community, Middleton High School. Would those students please stand? We thank you all for coming. You may be seated. Now, the students are here with a national award-winning program cleverly entitled Court with Class. And what we do is invite students from across the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If the invitation is accepted, we send the students material about the case that they will hear. They might engage in other outside activities relating to the case. They come to court and listen to oral argument. And then at the end of our second case, meet with a justice who discusses with them the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the case that they have heard. And today, the presentation will be made by Justice Ann Walsh Bradley to you all about this case. If anyone is in the courtroom and wishes to have a summary of the case, if you raise your hand, we'll give you one. It's easier to hear and understand a case if you know something about the facts and the legal issues. Seeing none, let me then introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. Just make sure all the seats are occupied. Sometimes they're not. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Brooks, and to his left, Justice Patience Robensack, and on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. All are here and accounted for, so we may proceed. I will call the first case. 07AP1849CR State versus Jordan. How do you pronounce your client's name? Gayeskis. Thank you. Christopher Lamb, Assistant Attorney General, will argue on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. Mr. Lamb.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. When the court writes its decision in this case, the state requests that the court address several issues. The first thing, of course, is that we would like the court to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and reinstate Mr. Gayeskis' conviction for sexual assault. Second, we would like the court to hold that Mr. Gayeskis did not present sufficient evidence at the post-conviction hearing to establish deficient performance by his trial attorney. Third, we would like the court to hold that the Court of Appeals misapplied the Strickland test for deficient performance, in particular by improperly shifting a client responsibility from the client to the attorney. In addition, because this is one of those rare ineffective assistance cases that actually focuses on the deficiency prong of Strickland as opposed to the prejudice prong, and is also one of those rare ineffective assistance cases that actually requires focusing on the defendant's burden of proof at the post-conviction hearing, we think it's important that the court's opinion also guide lower courts as well as the attorneys by making clear, only by reiteration in some cases, what has to be done in terms of the post-conviction hearing. First, that the defendant has the burden of proving ineffective assistance of counsel by clear and convincing evidence. That the objective reasonableness of the attorney's performance depends in the first instance on what the defendant provides the counsel in terms of notice as to what the defense expects the attorney to do in the future. The third thing is that the court should remind circuit courts that they should make explicit findings of fact including determinations of credibility, and relate those findings to the court's conclusions of law. And finally, that an appellate court must review the record of the Mockner hearing most favorably to the circuit court's decision.
Well, what about all this talk in your brief about the clear and convincing evidence? Did you mention that phrase?
Clear and convincing evidence, yes.
All right. What has that got to do with the standard of review in appellate court?
Well, in the appellate court can't really do an effective review of the ineffective assistance hearing unless it knows what the burden of proof is for the defendant.
And what's that burden of proof? It has to be, I would assume, for facts, not for the question of whether the performance was deficient, which was a question of law.
Well, the question of whether a performance is deficient and whether it's prejudicial, those are questions of law. But he still bears the burden of presenting sufficient evidence to get to that conclusion. That evidence has to meet a clear and convincing standard.
All right. But our review is, was the finding of the trial court clearly erroneous, right?
Right. That's the standard of appellate review.
That's right.
You can't know whether it's clearly erroneous in many respects. Well, you can't know whether they've reached that point if you don't know what the defendant's burden is in the first instance. If the trial court, for instance, finds that the facts prove a certain thing, those facts rise to, say, a preponderance of the evidence, but would not satisfy a clear and convincing evidence standard, then that's clearly erroneous, and that's what the court would be reviewing to determine whether the defendant has met that burden at the lower level.
And that's what we do in criminal cases beyond a reasonable doubt. The facts
right.
have to show that.
Right, exactly. And once you look at the facts and determine which facts the court found, and in this case there's an issue about how you determine what facts the court found, because the court did not really make specific findings of fact. The court said, I agree with the state that the defendant is just bringing this stuff up now. The court did not make, in that sense, specific findings that this happened, or this didn't happen, or this didn't happen. Did not make specific findings about the credibility of the witnesses.
Now, there are other issues that the Court of Appeals didn't reach. Newly discovered evidence, for example, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Suppose that we would agree with you. Does that end the case?
Well, there are kind of two alternatives. We did not argue in this court the issue of the newly discovered evidence. That is an issue that was fully dealt with in the lower court. The court could presumably rely on our briefs in this.
Well, the order said we're not going to. The order said we
then
don't.
You would simply remand. You could remand it to the Court of Appeals for a determination on that, or if you're not satisfied with the fact finding that was done by the trial court on that issue, you could remand it to the trial court for further findings of fact.
Any other issue that might have to be remanded? Should the court agree with you?
I don't think there are any other issues that needs to be remanded on. The important thing about an ineffective assistance claim is that the post-conviction motion establishes the boundaries of what the issues are that went before the trial court. So anything beyond that would not be, I think, within either the Court of Appeals or this court's authority to tell the circuit court to deal with.
Mr. Wren, was there in the interest of justice claim also before the Court of Appeals?
There was a claim raised. It was argued. It was briefed anyway.
That wasn't decided by the.
That was not decided either because they reversed. Mm-hmm. And our position, of course, is that there is no basis for a reversal in the interest of justice. There are a couple of clarifications that I did want to make on this. One comes out of Mr. Gajewski's brief, where he states that. At page 10, that before this assault occurred, that Mr. Gajewski, that he knew Rebecca, or that Rebecca knew him, that's not correct. Rebecca specifically testified that she did not know Mr. Gajewski before the sexual assault occurred. She knew him from school, from around school by reputation, that kind of thing, but did not know him personally. The second thing is a possible point of confusion that the panelists on my new court raised after reading all the briefs here, and that had to do with the two conversations that are dealt with in this case. Two conversations occurred. They thought there might be a little confusion as to what we're dealing with here. One conversation occurred either on Monday or Wednesday after the assault. It's not clear which date because Mr. Gajewski says it was a Monday and Rebecca said it was a Wednesday. But they both agree that that conversation involved Mr. Gajewski telling Rebecca that he had told another friend, Mike Hoff, that they had had sex that weekend. She was cross-examined about that conversation as a way of showing that they wouldn't have had that conversation if the sexual assault had in fact occurred non-consensually. That was part of Attorney Kelly's efforts to attack her credibility with the idea that you wouldn't have been talking with him if in fact he had raped you the way you say. So that conversation is not the one that's at issue in this case. The conversation that is at issue is the one that occurred on Friday, May 13th. The one that's recounted in more detail in the notes of Attorney Kelly and that provide the basis for the claim that those notes, the information reflected in those notes, should have put him on notice that he needed to conduct further investigation to come up with a credible motive for what they alleged was Rebecca's false claim of sexual assault. One of the problems that we have with the Court of Appeals decision, there are several, but one of them has to do with the discrepancy between what the ineffective assistance of counsel claim was and what the courts said was ineffective assistance. The only claim of ineffective assistance was the alleged failure to develop evidence about a credible motive for a supposedly false claim of sexual assault. What the court actually decided two claims of ineffective assistance. One claim where they said the counsel was ineffective for failing to cross-examine Rebecca about the cell phone number that she allegedly wrote on Gajewski's hand. There was no claim that counsel had failed to cross-examine, or that had done an inadequate case of
cross-examination. Well, is the court limited to what the counsel says, or to what the counsel claims, or what the defendant now claims, or when they look at the record, can the court say, hey, there are a lot of other issues here?
I think the court is limited by what the claim is. That's part of Strickland, and I think that's part of what this court's decisions on adequate pleading deal with, that it's up to the defendant to specify, and this is what Strickland says, specify what the particular instances of ineffective assistance were. They never claimed inadequate cross-examination on knowledge that was known to them. They only claimed ineffective assistance by failing to develop evidence of a credible motive for a false charge. And I think that the motion itself defines not only what the trial court is supposed to decide, but what this court is authorized to review.
Counsel, I'm not persuaded that the burden of proof at the post-conviction motion should be clear and convincing evidence.
And why is that?
Because it seems to me one case you cite is a civil malpractice case, and that talks about focusing on, as I read it, the civil malpractice, and does reference the clear and convincing burden of proof applies to claims of due process violations. Mm-hmm. That's what it says
in the cite.
What is that? That's the Colwell case?
Versus Colwell.
Yeah, 209 was second. Then there's the Lukaski case that you cite, but that had a situation where it said clear and convincing applies where the attorney is unable to testify or is not available to testify. And it could be that this is clear, satisfactory, and convincing. I'll tell you, a technique used every once in a while by burden judges, and they say, I find this to the requisite burden, because as things are going fast and furious, you're not sure what the requisite burden is, but you know it when you see it, I guess.
That might be part of the problem.
Yeah, but I am not sure that our case law says what, in this kind of a situation, the post-conviction hearing, where the attorney is present, what the burden is. Well, and Lukasik was not ineffective assistance. It was grounds for withdrawal of a plea. The other case you cite is State v. Flores, which was overruled. That's a court of appeals by State v. Knight. So there's a real question whether you can rely on a case that's been overruled, even not on that point, which has never been decided by this court. So that's what I'm concerned about. It seems to me that our law is not clear on this issue. I'm not convinced that it is clear, satisfactory, and convincing.
I frankly agree with you. I don't think I agree with your review of the cases. And in fact, one of the problems that we have when we bring these cases up, when we deal with these in the Court of Appeals, particularly when we're trying to talk about what the burden of proof is, what the standard of review is, that we have to do kind of CFs and so on, I know that Pierce v. Colwell was a collateral case with the court saying that in the ineffective assistance claim, he had to prove by clear and convincing evidence.
Why do you think it should be clear and convincing? You don't have case law. Why aren't you arguing it should be clear and convincing because?
Well, I think it's clear and convincing because of the deferential standard to be applied to counsel's conduct, that you don't want a mere preponderance to be the basis for overturning counsel's conduct.
We have deferential standards to the trial court all the time on erroneous exercise of discretion, and we never say there that it means that the findings of fact have to be clear and convincing to persuade us otherwise to the trial court. I mean, is that the only reason you're doing clear and convincing?
I think that, well, one of the points I was making was that in terms of his argument, one of the things he's arguing is that the Court of Appeals did the appropriate thing here, which, in effect, from my point of view, was really looking at the evidence and taking a different view of it.
That's a different issue.
Well, I understand, but
you can say that they weren't deferential. You can say they can't retry the case. But that doesn't go to what your whole brief is postured on, as far as I know, which is clear and convincing evidence at the trial court.
My argument is that the court should be establishing a standard of what somebody has to prove at a hearing. I mean, you can't simply go in to a court and have the trial court saying, I find it the appropriate standard, if you don't know what the standard is. And if the position is correct, and I think there's a large amount of truth to it, that this court, that this state has not specifically established a burden of proof.
What does Strickland say?
Strickland doesn't say. It talks about a high...
Not for the feds, why isn't it good enough for us?
Because they didn't have to decide in that case.
What are the other courts in the country?
The other courts that I cited impose the clear and convincing standard. It's on footnote 11 in page 29 of my brief. An array of states hold that clear and convincing is the standard for proving ineffective assistance of counsel. But that's what the defendant's burden is.
Is that a majority view or a minority?
I believe it is. I mean, it's a lot of states that simply don't set out a standard, because a lot of times they just go to the prejudice prong and assume, even if you assume all these facts are true, there's no prejudice involved in this case. And that's why when you're dealing with a deficient performance prong like we are here, the issue of what the defendant has to prove becomes more important, because those are the facts that are going to underlie the findings of whether it's been deficient performance, and then if it's deficient performance, whether it's going to be prejudicial.
Counsel, I'd like to clarify what exactly we're talking about. This sexual assault allegedly occurred, or did occur, because the jury found it did, on May 7, 2005. Then there's a conversation on
May 9th or May 11th, depending on which of the two you believe.
Was put into evidence.
That was put into evidence, yes.
And the defense purpose of putting that in was to show you wouldn't be talking to somebody who sexually assaulted you previously. With respect to the subsequent, and consent is
This has to be without that person's consent. So consent is an issue in this particular charge.
Right.
So the logic of the defense was afterwards they were having contact, and so you wouldn't have contact with someone who assaulted you.
Right.
But the issue the jury has to decide is whether there's consent at the time.
Right.
The only conversation then at issue for purposes of ineffective assistance is the May 13 conversation.
Yes, right? The one in the parking lot.
And that conversation occurred between the victim and the defendant.
Correct.
So the defendant would possess knowledge, presumably, of exactly what happened, what was said, and who the participants of that conversation were.
Correct.
Right? What exactly did he tell his lawyer, and what was the lawyer allegedly deficient in not pursuing? Did he tell the lawyer the kinds of detail that we now know about the May 13th?
No. What we know is we have the notes from that meeting. The notes are, you can find in the appendix at page 129. And this is the entire summary of any of the conversations that occurred in the week following the assault. And what the note says is that Gajewski told his attorney there were short conversations throughout the week. In the motion, he says they passed each other in the hall, they said hi, bye, kind of thing. Those are the short conversations I assume he's referring to. Then he says the only significant conversation was on Friday, at which he describes that he told her what he was doing that weekend. She said maybe she was going to a concert. He said maybe he was be at a party. She wrote his cell phone number on his hand. He tried to call her over the weekend several times, didn't get an answer. That's it. We don't have any of this information that he passed on to his attorney. His attorney says he'd never told him. At the Mockner hearing, there's no dispute that these are complete notes and accurate summaries of what was told to Attorney Kelly by Mr. Gajewski.
But what import, if any, should we put on the fact that this is information solely within his, between he and the victim, those are the two people who know about this. This isn't some evidence out there that if the attorney would have done their job better, they would have discovered that and the defendant never knew about it. What if any, importance is there on the fact that the defendant knew about the specifics of this?
That's a large part of what we're saying is that the defendant, the attorney, the reason was the attorney's assistance begins in the first instance with what the client puts the attorney on notice about. The attorney, there's obviously going to be some kind of conversation, tell me what happened, you know, any conversations, that kind of thing. But Strickland itself says that the reasonableness of an attorney's conduct is going to be, is often determined by what the client informs the attorney about. In this case, what they agreed, these notes come from a two-hour, open-ended, face-to-face meeting. It's the only face-to-face meeting they had. They had a number of telephone conversations between the two of them over time. I don't know whether preceding or after this, but throughout the representation. This was the only meeting. And Mr. Gajewski says, I gave him the gist of what my conversations were about. I don't see when you compare this with what he said at the trial, or what he said at the post-conviction motion hearing, how anyone could say that he did anything other than withhold information from his attorney. At the post-conviction hearing, he says, she came up to me, she got really angry, she called me an asshole and told me to fuck off. That would be in that conversation if that occurred. Any client, no matter, even a client with barely a brain, would know enough that when you're talking to an attorney, and the attorney says, tell me about this. What contacts did you have? What happened? And leaves it open-ended and says, you tell me. And the client leaves out the things like that as things that apparently from the client's point of view aren't very significant. I don't know. I just think that Mr. Kelly acted reasonably when he concluded from that description that there was nothing more to look at in that conversation.
Okay, so fast forward to if this information was introduced at trial, or reversing, What would it show? It would show that they had contact again and that she had interest in him post the date of the assault.
Right. It shows, it's basically is another instance of what they've already brought up with the first conversation. You wouldn't be having this conversation if you had actually been raped by him. What they're claiming is that if he had done the investigation, he would have found out, if he'd asked more questions, he would have gotten this other information from Mr. Gajewski about these additional words, this anger and so on. But even if you take that as a fact that he would have found that, we still don't know. And this is what I think they had to show and affirmatively refused to show, was how that would have affected Mr. Kelly's representation. Would it have made a difference in his recommendation that Mr. Gajewski testify? I don't see any way that they get to this evidence of whether that exchange actually occurred unless he testifies, because she testified at the post-conviction motion hearing. No, she did not ask him to go out. No, she did not want a relationship with him. In order, if she testified that same way at the trial, the only way to put it in dispute is by calling him to testify. He didn't testify. The only reason he didn't testify was because he had this huge credibility problem from a police report. In the police report, and as it's described in the post-conviction motion hearing, in the police report, he said that he had not had sex with her. He lied to the police.
And that's part of what I'm wondering. I mean, even if you could put this in, would a lawyer put this in? You know, because he's caught. He can't put his client on the stand, and unless she admits the things in this statement, who else is going to testify about this conversation?
Right. I agree, and that's his burden to make that case.
And counsel, along those same lines, didn't Mr. Kelly even testify at the Boxner hearing that even knowing all of this new information, and not just new, more additional details, but a transformative nature in the tenor of the conversation, that from being a neutral kind of colloquy, what are you doing this weekend, I am doing this, what are you doing, into a scorned lover situation that we hear about for the first time at the Mockner hearing, the post-trial hearing. Didn't Mr. Kelly testify at the Mockner hearing that knowing all of these things, that he still wouldn't know that he would call his client to the stand?
I'd like to agree with that, but it's not quite correct, Your Honor. That's one of the things. They came up to that point, but he was never asked that question. What he testifies to, the examination that goes on is, I want you to, knowing all the stuff you know now, would it have figured into your calculation?
Right.
And then Mr. Miller says, I don't want you to tell me what you would have done.
Right. Thank you for clarifying that ambiguous point. It is not stated that he would have called his client.
Exactly.
To the stand.
Exactly. In fact, they affirmatively back off that statement.
They don't want the answer to that question.
Well, you can ask Mr. Miller what the reason was for that. But the problem is that's his burden, I think, to show, not only to show that this would have affected the calculation, but how it would have affected the calculation.
I didn't mean that as I meant that as a reading, a plain reading of the question. The question did not call for that.
Right, exactly. Yes, Your Honor.
Well, now, does then that fit with what, as I understand it, was your third point, that they misapplied Strickland because they shifted stuff from the client to the lawyer? That is the burden. If I understand you, the burden was in the client to tell the lawyer the truth.
Yes.
And that the lawyer, not necessarily, have to check on the client's story.
Well, it depends, and this is where it becomes very fact-contextual.
Well, it's a he-she situation.
Right.
So you got two people. They're the only ones that are there, although there are people close by, right?
Right.
People within 3 feet still sleeping, right?
Right.
But none of them apparently heard anything or saw anything.
Right.
Okay. So what's your argument on shifting from the client to the attorney?
Well, their position is that the information reflected in the attorney's notes was sufficient to put Mr. Kelly on notice that he should have asked more questions about that meeting. Had he asked more questions of Mr. Gajewski, it would have led to this scorned lover motive. And our position is there is nothing in those notes that would lead a reasonable attorney to think that there was anything more going on than this conversation, which bears on the issue of whether she was lying, not whether there's a motive. So arguably he could have asked about the cell phone, but that only gets you to a position that says, well, you wouldn't have been asking for the cell phone if he'd actually raped you. It doesn't get you to the position of what's the motive for making that. He offered motive at the trial. He offered a clear motive, and he offered what I thought was a reasonable motive based on the information that he asked Rebecca at the trial and cross-examination, and that was consistent with the information his client provided him.
What about his closing argument? Wasn't his closing argument was that she was lying to protect her reputation?
He actually had two arguments on closing argument. The first one was that she was lying to protect her reputation. That was the motive argument. And that was a motive argument that he advanced in the opening statement, that he advanced by cross-examination of her. I think it's on pages 160 and 61 of the trial transcript, where he says, we grills her on the reason for saying this, because she wanted to protect her reputation. And in closing argument, he raises the reputation argument again. The second argument he makes goes back to testimony at the trial that she had not kept some doctor's appointments. And that the reason she had not kept the doctor's appointments was that she was not worried about getting a sexually transmitted disease, AIDS, or anything like that. And the reason she wasn't concerned about that is because this never happened, that there was never any sex at all. So there were two arguments that were actually made.
In opposite directions.
Yeah, pretty much in opposite directions. But the first one going to the motive for a lie, and the second one being that, but in fact, it's a lie because it never happened. And his argument there is, look at her description of the situation when the whole thing occurred.
I have a couple of questions about footnote 11. One, this Georgia case, defendant must rebut by clear and convincing evidence the strong presumption that his attorney was effective. Is there such a presumption in Wisconsin?
If you're following Strickland, there is.
Mm-hmm. All right. Is it a presumption or deference?
I think the deference arises from the presumption that the attorney has acted reasonably unless proven otherwise.
You wouldn't instruct the jury on a presumption. Okay, the burden is to prove both prongs. Prejudice by clear and convincing too. Isn't there anything in law here?
I think what the proof is that it's the clear and convincing on the prejudice prong is derivative in a sense of the proof of the clear and convincing proof of the facts, that the facts themselves rise to a level of maybe deficient performance, but the facts themselves don't then rise to a level of prejudice by clear and convincing evidence.
Right. Which is a legal issue.
The conclusion of prejudice, the conclusion of deficient performance are both legal conclusions.
Thank you, Mr. Wynn. So also, when you have rebuttal, I'm going to be asking you about the third issue, and that is review in the light most favorable to the determination of the circuit court. View the record in the light most favorable to the circuit court's decision, and where you get that standard.
Okay.
From for ineffective assistance.
I will say that's inferred. Thank you, Your Honor.
Stephen L. Miller representing the defendant, Mr. Gajewski.
Members of the court and counsel, the evidence is undisputed that Gajewski told his lawyer that he had a significant contact with the complainant on Friday, May 13th, which was 5 days after the alleged assault and 3 days before the assault was reported. Gajewski told his lawyer four things, all of which are contained in the lawyer's notes. And I would add as an aside that Attorney Kelly testified he had no independent recollection of that conversation. It's based strictly on his notes. Well, the first thing he told his lawyer is that he had met with the complainant and that they had had a conversation on this date again, between the time of the assault and the report.
Counsel, just so it's clear, didn't Mr. Gajewski testify at the post-trial Mockner hearing that the notes were an accurate summary of the conversation?
Yeah, well, he said he did not believe he told his lawyer anything other than what were in his notes.
Okay.
Right. So we're not arguing that he told his lawyer more than was in his notes.
I just didn't know where you were going with the comment about Mr. Kelly not recalling having an independent recollection. There doesn't appear to be any reasonable dispute that these are accurate summary of the media.
Other than the fact that notes are notes, and they're not verbatim. You know, so we're, you know, I'm not saying that it's there's any inaccuracy here. I think we can rely on the notes to determine what was said.
Okay.
I'm not disputing that. Second thing was that they, at this meeting, which occurred between these two events, which I think the timing here is extremely important, that they discussed their weekend plans. She said she was maybe going to a music concert. He was maybe going to a party. And then the third thing he said, which I think really is the critical fact here, he told his lawyer that she wrote her cell phone number on his hand. And then the fourth thing he said was that he had tried calling her that night or the Saturday night or some other time, at least twice, and that she had not answered. That is what he told his lawyer. Now, this is in the context of a case with, I think everyone would agree, certainly the trial court made the comment that there was very close facts. Even, I think you could argue, somewhat improbable facts. There was no physical evidence. There were no eyewitnesses. The sole focus of the trial was the complainant's credibility. So this is, in my view, this is not a case where the client has provided his lawyer with information that could lead to exculpatory evidence. This is a case where the client provided his lawyer with exculpatory evidence. Because I don't know how one can reasonably view the fact of her writing her cell phone number on his hand prior to the report as being anything but inconsistent with the allegations. At least I think a jury could conclude that. You know, it's not this court's decision and not the trial court's decision as to whether or not it happened or didn't happen. The question here is impact on the jury. Does it undermine confidence in the outcome of the case? It's not for the trial court to decide whether Gajewski's testimony is credible or the complaining witness's testimony is credible. They are at odds. That is the issue to be resolved at trial. The question is whether this is evidence that would have had an impact on the jury.
Counselor, how would that have come in if he was not called to testify in his own trial?
If he was not called to testify, there's several ways it could have come in. Obviously, cross-examination. The state called the complainant at the post-conviction hearing. She at no time denied that this meeting occurred. When she was specifically asked if she gave the defendant her cell phone number, her answer was, "I do not recall." Also, there was a witness to this meeting, Casey Connor, who also testified at the post-conviction hearing. He did not.
But isn't the first we learn of Casey Connor's witnessing this conversation post-trial?
Yes.
And
yes.
So that goes back to Justice Rogensack's question. Other than cross-examining Rebecca Baltz, Mr. Kelly knowing that he cannot call his client, at least he had made that determination at the time of trial, and we'll talk about the post-trial motion transcript in a little bit. But in terms of Mr. Kelly's understanding at the time of trial, he cannot call his client because of the crucial. You yourself said it came down to a credibility determination.
Right.
You styled it in terms of Rebecca Baltz's credibility, but Mr. Kelly's obviously aware, and we're all aware, that Mr. Gajewski had a credibility issue for himself.
Right.
So other than cross-examining Rebecca Baltz at the trial about the cell phone writing incident, there really is no way that Mr. Kelly can establish that that occurred, is there?
Assuming he is limited to strictly what his client told him, that is correct.
What else is there?
Well, my argument is that this triggered a duty to investigate. I mean, that's all the more reason it needed to be investigated. You know, who was there? When did this happen? How do I prove this?
Well, then it turns out that Casey Connor was there, at least according to the post-trial. But Connor testifies that he doesn't hear any content of the conversation. True?
That's correct.
And he didn't see her write anything on Gajewski's hand.
That's correct.
So again, I don't mean to belabor the point, but it seems to me that Mr. Kelly is stuck with Rebecca Baltz's response to his question on cross-examination, no matter what that response is.
Now, you're talking about just the evidence in the notes, or are you talking about post-conviction evidence?
At trial.
Okay.
At trial, to establish that occurred, Mr. Kelly's point is going to live or die based on what Ms. Baltz says on the stand.
Okay, but you're presuming that question with the limited information that was provided in the notes, correct? Or are you asking me based on the post-conviction evidence?
You answer it however you want to answer.
Well, based on the post-conviction evidence, I mean, first of all, I would say Casey Connor has more to offer here than simply that he saw them talking. He can describe the circumstances. This occurred at Gajewski's car in a virtually empty parking lot. I think the inference can be drawn that the complainant sought him out. And also, the timing of it is more clear. It's on Friday afternoon, and the report of the assault occurs on Monday morning. And I think there's also a possible inference there that something happened at that meeting that may have brought the assault. So I think he does clarify that to some degree. The other thing that could be done here is that, there would have been evidence from Amanda Romansky that, in fact, he was attending the prom the next day, and obviously that would corroborate the cross-examination to the extent that he was being told, or that she was being told, that he could not go out with her.
Sure, so far, these are all things that Rebecca Baltz did not deny during her cross-examination.
Not at trial. I mean, the jury had no knowledge of this May 13th meeting. Zero. None. So the cross-examination you're talking about was at the post-conviction hearing. And she did deny. She never denied the meeting on the 13th.
Right. So the jury did know.
No. The jury did not know about the May 13th meeting at all. They did not know what occurred.
They did not know that those two had a conversation about what their weekend plans were.
They did not know that. They did not know the May 13th meeting occurred. Period. The only thing they knew was that there was a minimal conversation on the Monday in the school hallway. That was it. That's all they knew. Attorney Kelly knew that was important, and the reason he didn't use the May 13th hearing is baffling. I mean, it's certainly consistent with what his argument was going to be here. But the jury had zero knowledge of the May 13th meeting. None. And I have advocated from the beginning here that this is a twofold ineffective claim. It's not only that, first of all, that he should have used the evidence he had about the May 13th hearing in his notes, but more so, I think, because it is exculpatory, but more so, I think it did trigger a duty to investigate. I mean, when the client hands the lawyer exculpatory information, and it seems to me that if anything triggers a duty to investigate, that has to be it. And we're not talking about hiring an investigator or finding witnesses or hiring experts. I mean, we're talking about talking to the client.
And so that brings me back to the original point that got this whole tangent launched, which is, if Mr. Kelly had asked Rebecca Baltz about the allegation, assuming that he did, ask her on cross-examination about her writing her telephone number on his client's hand, there really wouldn't have been any other way for Mr. Kelly to establish that she had, other than by what Rebecca Baltz said at that time.
Correct. And her answer at the post-conviction hearing was that I do not recall.
So is it your position that the defense counsel failed by just not asking more questions of the client? Is that the investigation?
That is essentially it.
I mean, not that he should have gone and talked to the victim.
Correct.
Just, he didn't ask the client enough questions.
Correct.
Well, the state says, look, you're shifting on to the attorney, if I understand Mr. Wren's position. You're shifting on to the attorney goofs that the client made.
Well, and it's just hard for me, you know, having done trial work for 8 years, it's just hard for me to fathom that argument. I mean, the most fundamental duty a trial counsel has is to talk to his client. And when the client starts giving you information and that in and of itself is exculpatory, you pursue it. You ask the who, what, where, when, why. I mean, there's no cost involved. There's very little time involved. It's basic, fundamental duty of the trial counsel.
Well, Strickland says you can assume that there are strong reasons for what the lawyer did, and that here he has a client who is lying to the police. He feels he can't put him on the stand. So what is he going to do? He makes the strategy choice of going with the client. The client never had sex with this girl. And takes the other strategy of trying to shake her credibility by saying, hey, she continued to talk with him. You don't do that if you've been raped.
I mean, we can debate, I suppose, how much of a credibility problem that is. I mean, in the cases I handled, about half of them, the defendant initially denies and then later admits. But the point is, with Mr. Kelly here, he had nothing to benefit. There was no benefit to putting the client on the stand. I mean, the calculation, which he agrees in his post-conviction hearing, is a matter of weighing the benefits against the cost. And the calculation that he made initially was that there was no benefit and there was a cost. It was an easy decision. On the other hand, he's walking into the case without motive evidence, without evidence that suggests that the complaining witness here, the assault may not have occurred, actions inconsistent with that assault. What we're proposing here is evidence that addresses those issues as significant evidence, and that changes the cost calculation completely, the cost-benefit calculation completely. And I did not ask Kelly that question because it is an objective standard. I mean, you know, and I'm asking him to decide it in hindsight. So I didn't think the question was really useful, other than to ask him, would this have changed, you know, your calculation? Would it have made a difference in your calculation? He agreed it would, and he agreed it was important evidence, and he should have used it.
Well, it's not only whether he would have put his client on, but the question is also whether if he had probed on motive, and showed more clearly that she had a motive for not telling the truth, the question is, would that have changed the result or at least undermined confidence in the outcome?
I don't think there's any question it would have. Again, the facts were close, the credibility was paramount, there was no witnesses, no eyewitnesses, no physical evidence, and the state pounded that issue. Why would she lie about this? He cannot give us a reason.
How long was it? Was this a jury case?
Yes.
How long was the jury out?
I don't know. I'm not sure it's recorded in the transcript, at least.
What do you think? You're relying very much on the facts. What about on the law and the question of the standard of proof that Justice Brandley raised?
Well, I've had trouble from the beginning even understanding the state's argument here. I mean, the process is that the trial court decides historical facts, and whether those historical facts are decided by clear and convincing evidence or some other standard, you know, that I'm not, I think that is an open question. The historical facts are what happened here. What did the trial counsel do? What was told the trial counsel? How did he respond? None of that evidence is disputed here. None of it is. I mean, the state conceded that the notes are an accurate representation, that this is what the client said, and we know what the lawyer did as a result, and he gave an explanation, and nobody has challenged Attorney Kelly's testimony in this case as to what happened. As far as Gajewski testifying, that's a proffer of evidence. I mean, that's I'm required to bring to the trial court what it is, what evidence there is, that would have been used or could have been used had the counsel not been deficient. And that evidence then is reviewed in terms of jury impact. You know, and I did, you know, I did cite McCallum on that. I know that's a new evidence case, but the point is it's not up to the trial court to decide whether he believes
or he or she believes Gajewski's evidence. The question is, you know, would it affect the outcome of the case? You know, would it undermine confidence in the outcome of the case? And so there's a built-in standard of review right there, and I think it's analogous to a new evidence in terms of you know, how we approach it. You know, to me, the only thing that the clear and convincing evidence standard would apply to would be the historical facts, because otherwise we're talking about a question of law. You know, we're applying undisputed facts or the facts that are found to questions of law, or to legal standards, which then are questions of law. So I've been somewhat baffled from the beginning as to exactly what the state is looking for here in that regard, and I think this legal standards are quite well established.
Counsel, I just heard you say that in the second prong of Strickland, there is already a standard of review. You mentioned standard of review. I'm looking at Strickland, and it says, with regard to the prejudice, the proper standard requires the defendant to show that there is a reasonable probability that, but for counsel's unprofessional errors, the result of the proceedings would have been different. And so apparently the state wants us to add to Strickland that the standard is that the court must find by evidence that is clear, satisfactory, and convincing to a reasonable probability that, but for, and you know, that sounds to me like nonsense.
Well, you're giving it and taking it away.
What does it mean? What does it mean to you to establish by clear and convincing evidence to a reasonable probability?
Clear and convincing evidence to a reasonable probability. I don't know what that means. I mean, the standard is whether it would affect the jury. You know, it doesn't undermine confidence in the outcome. Undermine confidence in the verdict. I mean, and I think, you know, here, I just want to quote Strickland real quickly here, too. It says, this is on page 626, although these principles should guide the process of decision, the ultimate focus of inquiry must be on the fundamental fairness of the proceeding whose result is being challenged. In every case, the court should be concerned whether, despite the strong presumption of reliability, the result of the particular proceeding is unreliable, because of a breakdown in the adversarial process that our system counts on to produce just results. And fundamentally, my argument is that without this evidence, and I've also made this as an interest to justice, without this evidence, without the jury knowing about this May 13th meeting and what occurred at this May 13th meeting 3 days before the report was made, without them knowing that, they don't have what they need to make a fair and reliable decision.
Mr. Miller, you just touched on something that's given me some concern. My understanding is that when this went to the Court of Appeals, you did argue in terms of, in the interest of justice, requiring a new trial, and also on newly discovered evidence. Those issues really have not been argued, briefed, developed here. What are you asking if we decide against you on the ineffective of assistance of counsel claim?
Well, I would ask that it be remanded.
Where?
To the Court of Appeals, for them to make that interest of justice decision.
What about other issues
and the, evidence
that are involved?
I'm sorry?
Weren't there other issues other than interest of justice that the
new evidence claim
and the new evidence would both go back to the Court of Appeals?
Yes.
Does it have to go back to the trial court, as the state said maybe the trial court didn't make adequate findings for your benefit?
Well, I don't. The trial court decided this on legal grounds. I mean, there was no dispute about these facts. I mean, there was no dispute that this is what the facts were in terms of historical, and then there was no dispute about what my proffered evidence would be. Now, I know the state disagrees with that proffered evidence, but that is indeed what it would have been, and that's what the testimony at trial would have been.
And that was the point of it. But in terms of historical facts here, there was never any argument by the state that my client didn't tell his lawyer these things and that his lawyer didn't do these things. I mean, that. So I'm not even sure how the burden of proof argument applies here. I mean, under these facts. I would like to, I don't know how much more time I have here, but...
You've got more than 5 minutes, okay. Because 5 minutes is when the orange light goes on, so your green light is still on.
To me, what the case really, really boils down to is this cell phone number on, you know, her writing cell phone number on his hand. I mean, to me, that is a huge red flag. I mean, I think any jury would have to look at that with some skepticism. And it goes not only to, certainly its actions inconsistent.
Counselor, but if that's what you think the linchpin is for this case, then the defendant has to be placed on the stand. You have no other way of getting that information in, because the boy that supposedly witnessed the conversation said he did not see her write a number on his hand, and she has said she doesn't know if she gave him the cell phone number. So you'd have to put him on the stand, and he'd have to admit that he not only lied to the police, but that he's guilty of at least a misdemeanor, right?
Right. Well, I mean, I think that the importance of it is in alerting counsel to the fact that there's more evidence out there. I don't think counsel acted reasonably in ignoring that fact and the likelihood that there was more evidence. There wasn't, the question wasn't even asked. There was no follow-up done on it. That is the evidence in this record. There was no follow-up on it.
But he said he didn't ask her anything further on cross-examination because he was concerned that he was going to get an untoward response from the jury, not a response from the jury that was favorable to his client.
But there was never any discussion, there's no evidence in the post-conviction hearing that he ever considered this. I mean, that he ever considered this information. I mean, there was nothing. What he said is that he should have used it, and he should have asked her. I mean, there was no questions of him about what the risks might be, or are you sure you would have done it, or nothing like that. I mean, he just plain forgot that it was there.
Okay, thank you.
Anyway, I thought I would end with a short quote from Felton. I think, you know, in terms of burden of proof and how ineffective claims are handled, a case is hard to beat. Justice Heffernan did a beautiful job on this, but I think it's important to understand that, when he writes, whether an attorney is experienced, whether or not attorney is experienced is not the criterion for determining whether counsel was effective in a particular case. And the fact that an attorney is ineffective in a particular case is not a judgment on the general competency of that lawyer. It is merely a determination that a particular defendant was not appropriately protected in a particular case. Ineffectiveness is neither a judgment of motives or abilities of lawyers nor an inquiry into culpability. The concern is simply whether the adversary system has functioned properly. The question is not whether the defendant received the assistance of effective counsel, but whether he received the effective assistance of counsel. In applying this standard, judges should recognize that all lawyers will be ineffective some of the time. The task is too difficult and the human animal too fallible to expect otherwise. We all know that trial counsel in this case is a very well-respected, experienced attorney, also a very busy attorney. The fact is that he was a true professional, testifying in difficult circumstances, post-conviction hearing, but the fact is he conceded that he made a mistake here and that he should have used his evidence, that he should have followed up on it, and that it was important. He conceded that he did not do a very good job with regard to the motive issue, he conceded that this would have been important evidence to establish both motive and inconsistent motive.
It seems to me from the transcript, he conceded he should have asked her about the cell phone number.
He also conceded that he should have used this evidence to establish motive, and the cites are in the brief, but I...
And he also does not come out and state that his decision would have been different, whether
think that is, I guess I disagree with the state that I have to prove more than that in terms of that possibility, because I cannot, I mean, for one thing, it's a hindsight determination for him to say, well, I would have or I wouldn't have. I mean, the fact is that, you know, that's a decision trial counsel has to make.
And another fact is, and another fact is that if Mr. Kelly had asked Rebecca Balls on cross-examination, after he had elicited favorable responses from her in some material respects, is that a fair enough characterization? In other words, he got her to acknowledge that she had engaged in conversation with him after the assault. True?
Sure.
And if Rebecca Balls, in response to the hypothetical question from Mr. Kelly, did you write your cell phone number on my client's hand at that meeting? If Ms. Balls had said no, Mr. Kelly, and therefore Mr. Gajewski, would have been stuck.
Correct.
Counselor, I have a concern about something Justice Crooks raised, and that was, there wasn't brief to us the argument that the decision of the trial court ought to be overturned based on either newly discovered evidence or in the interests of justice. And that would have been your argument to raise as an alternative to upholding the Court of Appeals decision. Why was it you didn't brief that to us?
Well, I did. I believe I mentioned that it had been argued to the Court of Appeals and that I was preserving it. But my understanding is that the petition for review was granted strictly on the single question of the ineffective claim.
Well, I think that our order says that we take the entire case, rarely limited to one issue or two, though there have been times when we do.
That is what the state was arguing on its petition.
Well, it wasn't their argument to make. I mean, they wouldn't want to argue that it should be, the Court of Appeals should be affirmed based on in the interests of justice or newly discovered evidence. That's really your argument.
Yeah, I mean, that's just one of those things that, you know, tell me what you want me to do, because I did mention it, that I had it.
What do you mean you mentioned it, counsel? You mentioned that he preserved it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the rules of appellate practice, I think, indicate that if you prevail, you don't have to raise the ones that you don't have to prevail on. Unlike a certification rule, where we take the whole
It was fully briefed with the Court of Appeals.
And you could have, though, you could have, under appellate law rules, argued other issues that support the trial court. The state could only argue issues that it raised in its petition for review. That's under the statutes or the rules.
Counsel, can I just verify something with you before your red light goes on? The defense of the first trial was that they did not have intercourse at all. Right?
Well, I don't think that's absolutely clear. I think it was unclear, frankly, exactly what the defense was. I mean, there was an intimation that it didn't occur. There was also an intimation that it was not consensual. And I think part of the problem with the case was that there was no real clear, I mean, he did not argue that it didn't happen.
What did he argue? He didn't argue to the jury. They didn't have sex, but if they did, it was consensual. He didn't.
No. He didn't do that, and nor did he say one or the other strictly. It's just you can't believe her. You can't believe it happened. I mean, it's a somewhat strange approach, frankly, than what I've seen in the past. And I think that, I mean, you know, the trial counsel is going into this knowing, everybody knew at that point that he had admitted it. But that was the reason that he didn't testify.
Right.
I mean, that was the initial reason he didn't testify. But on the other hand, I think basically he was giving, if you were to ask him that question, the answer would be is I was giving him a choice. I was giving the jury a choice.
You keep making the argument in your brief that the state never argued that there was no prejudice. Your position is that the state below argued that it was okay conduct on the behalf of defense counsel. And one time, I think you had a footnote or a statement that said, well, implicitly on page 19 of your brief, footnote 3, state did not contest the prejudice prong in the Court of Appeals brief. Therefore, it conceded that there's a reasonable probability that the result would have been different, e.g., Charlois' breeding ranches.
Respondent on appeal cannot complain if propositions of appellants are taken as confessed, which they do not undertake to refute. So your position here is the only issue is whether trial counsel is deficient.
Correct.
That's still your position?
Right, correct. In both the terms of the evidence that was provided him by the client and the evidence I believe he should have uncovered under his duty to investigate. But, yeah, the state has not argued prejudice.
Okay. And then footnote one. You have a lot of interesting things in your footnote, counsel. Defendant also made a new evidence claim and asked the Court of Appeals to reverse pursuant to the stat 752-35. As the Court of Appeals reversed on ineffective assistance of counsel, it didn't address these issues. Defendant does not waive those issues. And that's what our case law says. You've got to say that.
Yeah. It was my
understanding. You don't have to prove them. You don't have to brief them if you don't want, but the result is you have to go back.
You know, counsel, I know the red light is on, but several times, and it's important, several times you've mentioned that duty to investigate, and Mr. Kelly did not investigate as fully as he should have given the information that was disclosed to him by his client.
Right.
And it goes back to that cell phone number incident, which I think Justice Rogensack used the word linchpin, and you agreed, you endorsed that. What exactly, if he had pursued it, if he had done a further investigation, what would he have discovered?
Well, that's what in the post-conviction evidence, I believe I provided that. He would have gotten the full story from Gajewski. He would have, you would have the full conversation that she asked him on a date to the music concert, that he turned her down, that he told her he was going to the prom with another girl, that she asked him who was it, and he said it's none of your business. That he wrote her cell phone number on his hand and said, please call me, and then he...
Well, that's what launched this inquiry.
Right, but that was
the point is, can you say anything that he would have discovered that wouldn't have put him right back into the procedural posture he was in by living or dying by what Rebecca Balt said on cross-examination?
Well, other than having Gajewski testify, you're saying, then the difference would have been Casey Connor.
Who testified that he didn't hear either the content of the conversation or see her write anything on his hand.
Correct.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Wren, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I'd like to address a couple of points that were raised earlier. The question was, I think Chief Justice raised the question about how long the jury was out. It is in the record. From the time they were sent out of the court to the time they returned to the court, 89 minutes.
89 minutes.
This was not a close case from the jury's point of view. It was a credibility issue. Mr. Kelly vigorously attacked her credibility, walked her step by step through the assault to show that it was, as they said, improbable. Maybe they thought it was improbable. The jury believed that it happened. They believe that it happened, I think, in part because Tom Ashenbrenner's testimony about what Mr. Gajewski told him at the party, that he had, in fact, had sex, and that, in fact, Rebecca had said no several times, and he kept going.
The ineffective assistance of the post-conviction motion, though, as I recall, Judge Brady said he thought it was a close case. Am I incorrect on that?
I believe he did say that, but I mean, frankly...
On the post-conviction motion, that's
right.
What I took it.
Oh, I see,
yeah.
I see, okay.
I'm
yeah.
Sorry, you said this is a close case on the post-conviction motion.
Yeah, I would say that he did say something about that, yes. The question on the cell phone number, it's kind of interesting because there's a discrepancy in Mr. Gajewski's own statements about the cell phone number. In the motion, it's reported that she gave him the cell phone on a piece of paper. In his testimony, he says she grabbed my hand and wrote it on my hand. Presumably, he knows what happened, but he's giving contradictory statements there, like he gave to the cops, about whether sex occurred. And not only was the statement, the credibility issue is worse than I think it appears in the post-conviction motion, because if you look at the police report about what it's reported that he said, which was the basis for the credibility determination by Mr. Kelly, He not only denies that he had sex with Rebecca, he asserts that she asked to have sex with him and another person and that they turned her down.
Counsel, before your time is up, tell you what bothers me about this case. As I listen to the arguments, I listen to your comments so far on rebuttal. I think that this is an error correction case. I think that the trial court saw the facts one way on the post-conviction motion and ineffective assistance. We've been arguing about the facts and was it written on the hand, was it written on the paper. That's what all the argument, or not all, but that's what a significant part of the argument is. And now you want us to see the facts differently because the Court of Appeals saw it differently. And that's the way that I perceive this case. That's the way I hear the arguments in the case. But you have, in your brief, some legal stuff going on. And my concern is this. My concern is Strickland. I'm wedded to Strickland. You know, Strickland's been around since 1984. We have applied Strickland in many ways at many times. And now with your issues 1 and 3, you want us to change the way that we have looked at Strickland and applied Strickland. I think Strickland is sui generis. I think it sets out what the proper standard is, and then it says, and how you apply that. The standard for attorney performance a court must indulge the proper standard for judging attorney's performance is that of a reasonably effective assistance considering all the circumstances. And then how do you apply that? They say, okay, you apply it, a court must indulge a strong presumption that counsel's conduct falls within the wide range of reasonable professional assistance. What about prejudice? They set out the standard. Prejudice, the proper standard, requires the defendant to show that there is a reasonable probability that but for counsel's unprofessional errors, the result of the proceedings would have been different. And how do you apply that? They say it means reasonable probability means there's sufficient to undermine the confidence in the outcome. Now you have one argument, number 1 and number 3, and you want us to say, you say in the statement of issues, the Court of Appeals committed a fundamental legal error by failing to identify the burden of proof and that it's clear, satisfactory, and convincing. We don't have one case in this state, as I see it, that has said that the burden of proof here is clear, satisfactory, and convincing. With regard to the third issue, I don't think we have one case in this state that says that the it has to be viewed in the light most favorable to the circuit court's decision with regard to ineffective assistance of counsel. The case that you cite is sufficiency of evidence, and that's axiomatic in my mind. Sufficiency of evidence, you know, viewed in the light most favorable. So here's my question. Why should, if this is really just how you view the evidence, why should we mess up Strickland that we've applied since 1984 and not needed to add clear convincing evidence to a reasonable probability and not needed and never, this is new law you're asking for when this is really an error correction case? That's my question. Why are you doing
it? I don't think it's error correction. I mean, I think it's legal error correction. I don't think it's fact. In the
questions mostly were of factual determination, except for some of the...
Well, I don't think that the standard, what Strickland sets out, says what the level of that proof to get to that standard has to be.
So you want, with regard to prejudice, that to a reasonable certainty, by evidence that is clear, satisfactory, and convincing, there has to a reasonable probability. That's what you want.
That you have clear and convincing evidence, facts that are established by clear and convincing evidence.
That there's a reasonable probability that but for counsel's unprofessional errors, the result of the proceedings would have been different.
Both on the deficient performance side and the prejudice side.
Mm-hmm.
Both. The defendant bears the burden of proving both. I don't know why there would be, I don't see a reason to have a different standard on the two. I think the prejudice component will flow from whether you, what you proved on deficient performance.
Why after, 24 years that we've been applying Strickland, should we apply this standard rather than what Strickland says? The proper standard for judging attorney performance is, and it gives it. The proper standard for prejudice is, and it gives it. And then it says how to apply it. Why should we change the way we've been dealing with
Strickland? I frankly don't think it's changing.
But can you cite to me any case that in Wisconsin that says that the burden of proof of ineffective assistance of counsel is clear, satisfactory, and convincing for both prongs? Can you cite any case of that?
In this case, I don't think this court has had to decide that. I mean, that's the thing, is that most of your ineffective assistance cases come up in a context that doesn't require you
most
to decide what it is, how much evidence has to be produced down below.
Most of the cases come up on the second prong.
That's correct, Your Honor.
In fact, in Strickland, the court said easier to deal with the second prong on prejudice than to deal with the first prong, much harder prong, of did the lawyer do a reasonably objective, good enough job under these circumstances,
that's
right?
Correct.
But you are asking the court to apply clear and convincing evidence and from on the second prong, too, which is a legal question. The only legal question I know that has a burden of proof, which I think is a little strange too, and I've written that, was constitutionality of a statute, where the court says you have to prove unconstitutionality beyond a reasonable doubt. But that really doesn't mean you prove facts beyond a reasonable doubt. It means the finger on the scale is to uphold the statute. So the finger on the scale in Strickland is to uphold the lawyer. It's quite clear that way.
Agreed.
And the trial court.
Yeah. I'd be content, from my point of view, I think the clear and convincing evidence standard is absolutely appropriate at the deficient performance stage, where the facts are set. That's where, when we do the prejudice prong, we assume that all those facts have been proved.
Mr. Wren, defense counsel says there's no factual dispute here. So why are we talking about the standard if there is no factual dispute?
Well, he's saying there's no factual dispute. I mean, if you stop at the document itself and look at that alone, ignore the testimony that came in later, then we can talk about no factual dispute. But if you're getting into what came up later, then you're putting context into those facts. He's trying to back engineer from the evidence produced at the post-conviction hearing to what the attorney should have understood at the time. I don't see anything in a statement that she gave him his cell phone number. I think that it doesn't even say on there how he got the cell phone number. Just say he gave it to her. I don't see anything in that statement that would lead an attorney to think that there's a reason to continue asking about that conversation with the expectation that there might be something more significant going on. He had equally significant conversation the first day.
And Mr. Wren, therein, in the juxtaposition of the facts as they were alleged and apparently globally known by everyone except Mr. to everyone except Mr. Gajewski at the time of trial, as opposed to how they were brought out at the Mockner hearing, in your theory and your understanding of the majority view of the cases across the nation, is the need for an identifiable standard, clear and convincing, in terms of the factual dispute, which serves as the basis of determining whether there's a reasonable probability that there was an objectively deficient performance on the part of defense counsel. Do I accurately sum up?
I think that's right. Yeah, I think
majority
that's right.
Of jurisdictions?
Well,
is that accurate?
I don't know about the majority. The ones that I found.
Yeah, you had four or five.
But those are the ones that I found that actually stated a standard.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
That answers the need for a clear and convincing. I think that clarifies the need for some kind of standard to assign, highlighted by the difficult nature posed by the juxtaposition of the factual scenarios here.
The issue of the cell phone number, Mr. Miller says, is the crux. And I think, to the extent that there's anything in there, that has to be it, because everything is totally innocuous in that description. Even the cell phone number thing, I don't think leads to the idea that it was unreasonable for Attorney Kelly to conclude, okay, well, he had these conversations. Looks like this is good evidence that she's lying because she wouldn't have these discussions. It doesn't tell you anything that you're likely to discover that, particularly in light of what he's now saying, there would be no reason for Mr. Kelly to believe that that was the tenor of the conversation as opposed to what he was told at the time. And that is where the issue of deficient performance comes up. Was it deficient to not explore further based on what we know was in there? And looking from the point of view of a reasonable attorney, was it reasonable for an attorney to say, I don't think there's anything more there, I'll go on to other things, we'll develop another strategy, that kind of thing?
I didn't bring out my file on the petition to review. Your statement of the issues in your brief the same as the ones on the petition for review?
I believe so, yeah. Okay. I thought they were.
All right. Yeah. Did the state challenge prejudice in the trial court?
In the trial court, yes, that it was not. It was neither deficient performance, and it was not prejudice. So that's my recommendation.
What about the court of appeal?
On appeal, our position is that if you find deficient performance, then all that testimony becomes jury evidence. I couldn't say. I mean, I think it's going to come back the same way. But I don't think that's certainly not the standard.
You don't think it meets the test of undermining confidence in the verdict?
I think it'll come back the same way for the various reasons that Gajewski's not going to take the stand, but that's a decision. If you say this was deficient, then we're into a whole new ball game about what would happen down the road, and I'm not comfortable saying that we can say with confidence that everything would be the same. We're not arguing prejudice. If you find deficient performance, our view is it goes back and it has to have a new trial.
Thank you, Mr. Grant.
Thank you.
I want to thank Mr. Miller and Mr. Wren for excellent arguments this morning on an issue we have had a number of times and that comes up quite frequently in petitions for review, namely ineffective assistance of counsel. We usually get these cases on the prejudice prong, not the prong of whether counsel was ineffective. So this presented a new twist on an old issue of the court. Thank you very much. That N078P 1849 CR State versus Jayeski. The court will take a few moments in recess so that the students may leave if they wish to do so. And a different group of students from Mount Horeb High School may come in. I hope the students will have enough time to come back and meet with Justice Bradley.